Hello, and welcome back. Did we miss any? Do we miss anything? Has everyone resigned? Is it fixed yet? Before we start again, we're going to have another couple of Brexmas presents. Roz, it's your turn.
Fantastic.
And it gave me an electric shock. How did it do that? That is amazing. Sorry, can I work that into it?
It's a very dangerous gift.
My God.
It hasn't passed EU safety check.
Is that? Did you actually see me jump? Because I didn't. Like, right. Okay. Best comrades, Trump and Putin, magnetic finger puppet set. Yeah, I'm just putting on the expression I would get if this came out under the tree. Yeah.
Roz, your question, exactly from your findings, how much did Russians interfere in the referendum and did it make all that much difference to the result?
Oh, I can't answer that question, but I will try. The reason I can't answer that question is because nobody knows. Nobody knows what an effect social media advertising has on people's voting intentions. Because we're in uncharted water. You know, no one really knows what effect Tony Blair demonised had on people's voting intentions. And we sure as hell don't know what effect seeing lots and lots of Vote Leave and Eve.eu things on their Facebook did to people. What I will say is that people say, Brexiteers sometimes say, you know, I hear, Vladimir Putin didn't tell me how to vote. I cast my own vote. Yeah, of course you did. Yeah, absolutely you did. But in a globalised world, it ain't that simple. Because Vladimir Putin can pay for advertisements that appear in your very personal social media feed alongside your friend's stuff. And that is what makes the difference. And that didn't happen 5 years ago, and it didn't happen 10 years ago. Now, I couldn't possibly confirm to you whether or not the £8 million that Aaron Banks had in an account and spent on Leave EU advertising and Believe advertising. I can't confirm to you where that came from because none of us know where it came from. We've tried really hard, and you know, the DCMS committee has tried really hard, and we don't have a clue where that money came from because it doesn't seem to have come from his businesses, despite his assertions that his cash flow was brilliant. It wasn't really. And where did that money come from? That is something that I can't speculate on, possibly without libeling someone. So I won't. But I can say that it was definitely in Vladimir Putin's interest that we leave the EU. He wants to undermine the EU. And the other thing I would say, which doesn't often get said in the context of Russian interference in the referendum, and some people may not like to hear, but I think it was an influence, was the effect of Labour not wholeheartedly campaigning for Remain. Because we know Jeremy Corbyn campaigned for Remain, but it was, I think someone put it to me, on a 7 out of 10 level in terms of conviction. And we know from a speech he made only last week at the European Social Forum, I think, that he doesn't think that the EU enables him to pursue these policies he wants. Now, I'm not going to say either that there is a hotline from Seamus Milne, Jeremy Corbyn's chief head. I used to work with Seamus. I couldn't possibly say that. I'd be too terrified. Yeah. Sometimes I have nightmares that Seamus just there hovering over my shoulder going, you're not going to run that piece about Venezuela, are you? So I couldn't possibly say that. But I do think that there is an attitude in the Labour Party that at that level that Vladimir Putin's regime is not perhaps as bad a thing as it's always made out to be. And I think that may have fed into the decision to really not go hard on campaigning for Remain. So that's my two-part answer.
Thanks, Roz. And there's another one in. It's your lucky day.
If it's not a comic, I don't really want it, to be honest.
Might be an action figure.
Yeah, Marvel, I was going to say. Marvel action figure.
Uh,
Your question,
Andrew,
is what's the most important thing on international trade, your favourite subject in the whole wide world, that everyone is not talking about? What's the deep cut of the international trade?
Oh yeah,
world?
Deep cut. There's a it's got wheels.
It's got wheels.
So I might just sit on the floor and play with it as I explain.
Deep cut. There's a very obscure part of trade which is called services.
How do you spell that?
Yeah. So nobody wants to talk about that. Which is odd, really, because we're a services economy. So you would have thought that it would figure quite prominently in what the British Prime Minister was trying to achieve in the most important trade arrangement we've ever done. But not so much. We focused on goods. And I think that's sort of because with the sort of the services are very wibbly-wobbly. So, you know, on a good, you know, it moves from one place to another, it crosses a border, there is a place to check it. If you, as a country, pass a law going, we don't want this kind of chemical in goods, you can just stop the goods and check that they're that. Services are much harder, right? Like, if you start saying that we don't really trust the way that Honduras, what the qualifications are for becoming a doctor, your classic thing as a government is just to not recognise those qualifications, because you don't want a bunch of Honduran people coming over and going, I'm a doctor now, when you haven't vouchsafed on that. But services tend to go either way. Like a service export includes when people go over to your country. If you go over to France and your child gets sort of maths instructions to pass an exam, maths tuition, that would be a services export from France. So it's a real sort of mess of stuff, and people don't really get it, so they don't really talk about it. But they fucking should. Because if we, as we expect right now, leave the EU and do basically a sort of a classic-looking FTA, the sort of thing that the EU is doing currently with Japan, we would be at about what you'd get on WTO, really, for services. And that would involve a 59%, technically, reduction in our service exports to the EU. Now, that's a major fucking reduction. You do not want that to take place. But it is not discussed because it's complex, it's weird, and partly because there's been a very successful campaign. This, by the way, is exactly what I'm going to do while I'm opening presents on Christmas Day. This is the whole spiel. Exactly. My uncle will be sat in the corner of the room.
I bet they'll be thinking, wish we hadn't given Ian the boat now.
But so they've actually been weirdly quite successful with this really quite insanely vacuous Patrick Minford argument, which is basically to say the single market's been very bad for services or not very effective at services. The single market has been the most effective sharing of regulation on services in the history of mankind. The fact that it hasn't completed the project is simply a sign of how politically difficult it is to do services. But there's nothing anywhere else in the world, anything like how the single market operates, and so much so, in fact, that services across countries in the single market are very often flow much, much easier than they do, for instance, between states in the US. So it's actually been profoundly effective. It's been incredibly helpful for the British economy. It's turned us into leaders in financial services, leaders in aviation, leaders arguably in sort of telecommunications, and nobody says a fucking word about it. And that alone is so utterly insane that it would be considered on its own terms enough argument to just go, you have all completely lost the plot.
Thank you. So a few weeks ago, I read a very spurious piece seriously suggesting that Britpop paved the way for Brexit with its Mockney accents, rousing choruses and Union Jack guitars. So I tweeted a few kind of jokey suggestions of my own just to pass the time and had Robson and Jerome's version of the White Cliffs of Dover, Allo Allo, Fat Les, Nick Berry's Sunday evening rural police drama Heartbeat, The Wicker Man, and the On the Buses cinematic universe. Now, some people thought that I was being serious, including a former cast member of Allo Allo, but many more people chipped in with their own suggestions. I'll be reading out the best in a minute. But first, I want to ask the panellists what cultural artefacts they would put in the proto-Brexit canon of shame. Ingrid, would you like to start?
So these are things that we blame people for voting Brexit on.
Semi-seriously.
Okay, I will go Euro 96. I would go Euro 96, basically because we thought we were doing all right. And then we got our confidence back, and then it was completely decimated. And it's when we sort of think we're doing quite well, and then and then we get humiliated by Europeans. I think that's where it stems from. So I'm going to go Euro 96. My boyfriend's in. He'll be really, really angry with me about that.
Roz?
This one, I think it's those mugs, but it wasn't just mugs. It's spread. The ones that say keep calm and carry on. I don't know when they started. Did they start 5 years ago? Something like that? About
longer.
That time. Yeah. And they just kind of fostered, and then suddenly it was like everything, panic and carry on. Shag someone and carry on. I don't know. It was an endless listening and carry on. And I think this is what has got us into the mindset that we have, where it's all going to be okay. It's not going to be okay. No deal is not going to be okay. Brexit is not okay. And yet somehow it gave us this false sense of confidence that in Britain, things are okay if we can just sit down and have a nice cup of tea.
But those posters were originally printed for use in the event of a Nazi invasion of Britain.
Well, you see, so that would be the time to panic, in my view. Yeah. I would not want to be strategic. I would be wanting to join the resistance if I had the guts then. I would not want to be carrying on and getting involved in some kind of Vichy-style regime. I'm sorry, it's just... No.
Well, that's good to know. It's really good to know.
Were they never actually used?
They were never used. One was discovered in a junk shop like 10, 15 years ago, and then they became a thing.
Oh, wow.
Well, there we go. It was about Nazis. Ian, what would yours be?
Yeah, it's sort of in the same kind of line, I think, because the emotional effect is the same, and it's basically, it's Boris Johnson on Have I Got News For You? And... And I think that I totally hold myself up as a sort of an example of this just being a terrible cock-up, like a terrible psychological cock-up. Because it didn't just do this thing of creating this monstrous political ego that you can make the case that, you know, that the result might have gone a different way. Certainly when you take him and Gove together, I think that there was no sort of ostensibly centre-right, mainstream Tory voices in that campaign. It would have looked very, very different. It would have been much easier to just go, this is just a Farage thing. But it's deeper than that, I think, because it just sort of gave me, certainly me, and I think for a lot of other people, this sense of like, oh, British Tories, they're not actually that bad. You know, we disagree on, you know, fiscal issues, but actually they're perfectly reasonable and, you know, they can be quite funny and charming. And isn't there this sort of harmless, safe English, aren't we just a big field ultimately? And isn't it quite a... And you're like, oh no, they're fucking psychopaths. And I mean, not just on Brexit, but, you know, on austerity. And it's actually been a really quite vigorously right-wing eight years that we've had under these guys since they came in. I mean, less bad under Lib Dems, because even though they don't get much credit for it, you know, in my relentlessly negative view of politics, stopping shit from getting worse figures very high up in my hierarchy of accomplishments. And I just think that Johnson, that caricature, that persona that he had, really lulled us into a false sense of security about how safe British conservatism ultimately was. And we fucking paid the price, man.
I would, can I just actually, just on that, in fact, whatever is the opposite of Brexit canon, as in the thing that would have stopped it, I bewail the lack of a spitting image in these times. And I cannot understand why there is no satire in that vein. Because this is the most... We've never needed it more than we need it now. And to puncture both sides, to puncture the Remain side and the Leave side, just to put, so that equal treatment for everybody, so that we can see that ridiculousness of what is happening. But there is nothing, not really, out there to do that. And if we had a spitting image, something like a spitting image, I do think it would be incredibly important.
Well, Mog is his own spitting image puppet, isn't he?
Well, yeah. But that's the problem. People go, Brexit is beyond satire, but it's not. It's really not.
I'm going to choose smooth-talking Irishmen, two in particular. First, Terry Wogan, presenting Eurovision, making Europeans simultaneously look like foolish clowns and a sinister conspiracy plotting to rob Britain of its rightful prize, the home of pop. Then, to make matters worse, Henry Kelly, presenter of Going for Gold, in which befuddled British contestants were constantly outwitted in their native tongue by Klaus from Denmark, thus breeding resentment and insane desire for revenge. So, and they did form my idea of Europeans, is that they were both kind of like, when I was younger, they're both sort of laughable but constantly beating us. And I'm just going to rattle through the Twitter highlights. I think it's a pretty watertight canon, to be honest. We have It's a Knockout, Top Gear, Clarkson Era, Classic FM, John Lydon Advertising Butter, Morrissey's solo career, Brian May playing a guitar solo on the roof of Buckingham Palace, The Italian Job, Del Boy falling through the bar, Carling Black Label, the 1980s sitcom Duty Free, the cancellation of Channel 4's Eurotrash, the jelly and pork pies, the Blackcurrant Tango advert about Sebastian, the French exchange student, Maureen from driving school, All Royal Weddings, Howard's Way, Goodnight Sweetheart, Saint and Greavesy, Sunday Afternoon War Movies, Mumford and Sons, Mr. Blobby, Potholes, Cupcakes, Bunting, and Brian Harvey from E17 running himself over with his own car. So, well done, Twitter. It's not just a digital hellscape. Frankly, it's a miracle the result was as close as it was. Okay, laughter's over now. And we're going to extract ourselves from the immediate nightmare of Brexit and project ourselves forward to 2019 and the future nightmare of Brexit. Specifically, what situations might arise and what should Remainiacs like us in this room do about them? I have three potential scenarios for 2019, and we're going to explore them in a blue sky Steve Hilton, what if there were good Nazis? Think about it, kind of way. So, let your brains flow freely. Scenario one. May loses the meaningful vote sometime in December or January, then calls a general election and loses to Jeremy Corbyn. The twist is Corbyn is in a minority government with the SNP. So you've got a Brexit-curious PM propped up by partners who want to remain in the EU but leave the United Kingdom. Which could be fun. Start Ian. Corbyn has said he'd renegotiate Brexit. How doable is that? And because I watched, I'm not sure how many people saw the Channel 4 Brexit debate. Barry Gardiner made a very strong case for Remain, I thought. Because his plan for Brexit was basically remaining, but also leaving. And I just wondered if you felt that there was a more coherent strategy than that.
Yeah, so, I mean, If you are going to alter the future relationship document, then yeah, do whatever you like. You can stay as close or as far, you know, as you like. If you're going to alter the withdrawal document, which is the divorce bit, the legal bit, then no, you can't do anything. That's game over now, and that's done. And every time that, you know, Corbyn gets up and goes, and it's not just Corbyn, all the rest of them say, you know, all the IG lot say the same thing. We're going to go off. We'll get a much better deal. We'll just, you know, change the laws of gravity and then we'll come back and we'll do the quick vote and we'll be out in March. That's just nonsense. It's, you know, complete nonsense. The narrative arc of Nick Bowles and the Tory benches will give you this instruction, I think. Because originally he was of that sort of mindset and now he's changed it to, no, we understand, we just need the divorce bit. He's going for Norway in his case, which I think would be what Corbyn would end up with in that kind of scenario. It's once we're out, then negotiations restart, and then we will try to get to the point where we decide how that's going to go. If he's you know, in a coalition with Nicola Sturgeon, that's what he's going to have to go for. Because the SNP cannot afford to leave the single market. The basic reason that once you do that, the independence proposition becomes radically complicated. You need for Europe and Britain to be working according to the same regulations in order to make a viable, easy route into independence. So they will make that a precondition of anything. And I think Corbyn's a little bit closer to it, you know, than most people on the Tory benches anyway. So if it's after March, if nothing changes and we still leave then, that is a perfectly doable, very respectable thing to say. If anyone is claiming that you can do this kind of stuff before March, they're full of shit.
Ingrid, Corbyn spent quite a lot of time saying that EU neoliberalism was the source of our problems, including Brexit. But Shami Chakrabarti insists there's a lot of love in the room for Jeremy in Brussels. Do you think that in that event that he would actually end up doing much of that negotiating? Or would you see that being basically let Keir Starmer do it?
Yeah. Well, actually, I looked, in my head I had this vision. Again, it shows when you the danger in all of this is you sort of have to put your own prejudices or your own preconceived notions of what people are and things are to one side. Because I assumed that Corbyn, as we said earlier, was anti-EU and he knows fuck all about it and he hasn't made... I must stop swearing, actually.
Why?
There's a child. There's a child in the front row, for goodness sake.
I'm so sorry.
It's fine.
Is that allowed? I thought we put like an over 16 thing up there.
You're a terrible father. No, she's got to learn. She's got to learn. So I sort of assumed that Corbyn was a bit useless on all of this. And then I looked it up in time for tonight's show. And he'd actually gone to Brussels at one point as many times, if not more, than Dominic Raab, when Dominic Raab was Brexit Secretary. So he has made that journey. He's met Barnier quite a few times. It's not that he's completely outsourced everything to Keir Starmer. I just remember watching the Labour Party conference and being completely... I couldn't quite believe it. Again, I had too much time in my hands, so I watched every single one of the speeches.
Oh, my God.
I wasn't working at the time. In my dressing gown. Sweating.
Did someone give you a movie role just to rescue you?
Just to rescue me. I know. Yeah. They need to. And I just remember watching each speech, and just each speech of the major Labour Party players was completely contradictory to the previous one. And I didn't understand what was going on. And I got very angry, and I'm still angry. But I, who knows is the answer to that. I think some of the things that Corbyn says still to this day, in fact, a lot of the people involved in all of this, some of the things that they say, it's like, I don't think you actually understand what Brexit is. And I know more than you do, and I'm an actor. And so it is literally your job, and you don't know, and I know more than you do. So that's terrifying. Also, I feel great about myself, but also I'm not running the country. But some of the things that he says, I'm like, I don't think you're aware of the finer details. Again, someone like Keir Starmer, who's a lawyer, maybe let's leave it to that him.
Well, I did a thing for the Guardian the other week where they do a conversations issue at the end of the year, and the journalist basically just has to sit in and make sure it doesn't go off the rails or get stuck on one subject. And it was Stephen Mangan and Emily Thornberry, and Stephen Mangan was actually very good, like a really tough interviewer on the Brexit position. And Emily Thornberry did say at one point, we're going to be honest with people. And future tense. And I thought, that's really interesting, because nobody's really sort of done that. And when I was watching sort of Barry Gardner spiel, there was this sort of complete lack of just going, do you know what? We're going to have to take a hit on this. It was literally like, you can have anything you want. Just like one of those kind of like department store Santas that just kind of just goes for it. Do you want a car? Yeah, Santa will bring you a car. And then just leaves like the parents to sort it out. And I thought, you do need there to be a point at which you go, like, this is going to be the cost. And we've never really had that conversation with any politicians. Like, this bit is going to hurt, but then there's this bit. And, Ros, the other part of this scenario I'd like to ask about is, if there was this sort of minority government with support from the SNP, would another independence referendum be inevitable? Because we like referendums.
Haven't we had enough
spicy
referendum? Well, of course, a Corbyn government could take the wind out of the SNP's sails if it proved to be very, very popular north of the border. Or it might not. It might prove to be very, very unpopular north of the border. I think, tough one. I think actually the SNP is so well established in Scotland now that I think, 10 years ago I wouldn't have been so sure, but I think now Nicola Sturgeon looks like a powerful leader. She certainly looks a lot more capable than anybody in Westminster politics. And I think she could well press and demand an independence referendum. And my sense as well is that Scotland is moving gradually away from the rest of the UK, and it's kind of preparing. It's been a long journey, but it's ready now to do its own thing. That is my sense, and I'm not personally sentimental about the union in the way that our precious union, in the way that some people are. And I think that if Scotland wants to go its own way, then after watching the shit show in Westminster, who can blame them?
Yeah. Thanks, Rod. Scenario two, May fights a general election in January, which produces another hung parliament and more stalemate. May can't even get approval for a revised version of the deal, where we could leave the backstop unilaterally and have limited single market and customs union access. So we're closer to no deal. Now, are there any circumstances where May could be kind of strong-armed into a people's vote to prevent no deal, if that was the only other option?
Yes, I'm glad you asked me this question, because now I can talk about the most spectacular constitutional geekery. This might take some time. Okay, hold on. So today something interesting happened, because a lot of the background parliamentary battle that goes on day to day is about kind of trying to create a sort of no-deal firewall, trying to create basically like a backstop almost, like a last point that you can go to where MPs can step in and stop no deal. Now, that's what the Grieve Amendment was last week, and that's why last week I thought, you know, he's played an absolute blinder there, because by doing it to the, you probably don't need to do this, but once I'm in the nerdery world, I might as well just dig in deep. But I mean, by doing it to the business motion, it was attached to any debate, any sort of amendment that was coming out of, I beg your pardon, any motion that was coming out of Section 13 of the Withdrawal Act. And that just meant any part of the debate on her trying to leave got amendments attached to it. It was like this super version of Hilary Benn's amendment. It's really, really clever stuff. He's a smart one, that Grieve. However, today it all went a bit tits up. Never talk like I do, I'm so sorry. You have it. I'm sorry. Insecure, very badly paid employment in journalism, and it's like a terrible idea. And it started to go wrong. And I think the reason for that was this weird constitutional theory that popped up. And it popped up this morning, and then by the afternoon, lawyers for the House of Commons were saying that it was true. And it was to say that there's actually a kind of a wrinkle in the way that things are framed, that there's two sort of ticking time bombs that you have to look at. The first one is, if she gets a deal and it's voted down by the Commons, there's 21 days, and then a minister has to come up and go, there's no deal, and I'm putting the statement here. And then there would be amendments, according to Grieve. The other one, the other part of that, the other ticking time bomb was, what if she didn't get a deal in Europe? And after that, you had until the 21st of January for a minister to come to the House of Commons to go, look, there's no deal, and then you'd have the Grieve amendments. However, neither of those things have currently happened. She has got a deal with the Europeans, but there is currently no vote that's going to the House of Commons. She's refusing to say when it would even be. And some lawyers think that that means that there is now no reason that any minister has to come to make any statements to the House of Commons, and therefore there is nothing to amend, and therefore there's no obvious parliamentary mechanism to stop them doing no deal before March. Now, I don't think that's true. There must be another way of doing it. I also need to point out that this sort of hovered around the Commons chamber today, and May didn't seem to believe it was true, or had not understood what it was she was being asked, or had not been properly briefed on it. Or she's got separate legal advice. You know, that would be the good part. So at the moment, it's not clear what the mechanism is. Last week, we knew what people's vote can do to make sure that we can stop this. This week, it's not entirely clear. And that's one of the reasons that today really properly shitted me up, the stuff that was going through in the Commons today. I think we're in a much worse position today than we were this time last week. By Tuesday last week.
We as in Remainers or we as in the country?
We Remainers and also the British public. You can pick one of those. Yeah. And Europe. Everyone's
and
equally fucked. It's just, you know, only some people recognise it.
Russ, do you think that the Tories would let May fight another election? I mean, obviously nothing will remove her. It seems nothing will remove her. She will just stay and stay and stay. But I mean, could you see her fighting another election, or if one was forced, she would just have to go?
No, she can't fight another election because she, lost a majority pretty in the last one. And I don't think anything has changed in the public's attitude towards May since then, except to accept the perception that she's probably the least bad of a bad bunch. And that doesn't help when you're fighting against an opposition. So I think someone else would have to take over. I suspect it would be Amber Rudd, actually. She's my hot tip currently. Partly because she's a woman, and you know, why not pour the shit on women to deal, you know, deal with, get them to sort out messes you can't when the blokes screw it up. Sorry, I don't get it. But I think she also wants to do it for some reason. Why, I don't know, but she does. She looks hungry. I don't think there's anybody else in the Conservative Party who is capable, I don't think necessarily Rudd is capable of uniting them, but I don't think there's anybody else whom they could all get behind, even to a limited extent.
And Ingrid, if this were to result in a hung parliament, do you think that Corbyn could survive another defeat/victory? Like the last one? As someone pointed out, it's the only election where the winner seemed to lose and the loser seemed to win. But if that, because they're really pushing for an election, Labour are really pushing for election. I mean, I suppose in the way, obviously, Remainers are pushing for a people's vote, not complacently, but obviously with the intention of winning it. So I don't know how, but Labour, when they're pushing for an election, they seem to really think that they can win it, or that they will win it. I don't hear a lot of sort of doubts on that side. Do you think it would be... how certain do you think it would be? Because the polls are not reflecting the actual kind of nightmare on Downing Street situation.
It's funny that Jeremy Corbyn is holding on, and he is going to keep holding on until there's some natural disaster, apparently. And Theresa May, both of them, bless them, they're like, fucking holding on. They're like, I don't know, two old nemeses in... a Rocky film or something, one of the bad ones, they like Rocky 3.
3 is not bad.
No. I knew as I said that, I was like, he's going to pipe up. Right, 5 then.
That's fair.
But you know what? I have no idea. I have no idea because I can't see beyond tomorrow. There are so many permutations. My head is hurting now. Just listening to everything that's going on, so I have no idea how you're feeling. But it's just, yeah, I don't know. And it's okay to say that sometimes, I think. I think the last thing everyone needs is more people going, pretending that they know stuff and they don't. I don't know.
I would like almost, this is almost objectively, I'm generally a Labour supporter, but I would just sort of like to see what a Labour government, see what they would do. Because all the Tory party seems... Do you remember in the 90s how exhausted the Tories were? Yeah. For years before 97, to the point where actually you kind of photoshopped Tony Blair in earlier. It was like the height of Britpop, Tony Blair. And it's like, no, he didn't come until OK Computer came out and Britpop was kind of, you know, over. You know, but it just seemed as if John Major had left about 3 years before he'd actually left. And this government seems more... exhausted and done and incapable of achieving anything than that one did. And so there's a part of me that's almost like, even if I wasn't a Labour supporter, I'd be just like, let someone else
have a go.
Maybe that doesn't always work out. Let someone else have a go in political history. It doesn't always work. This guy's got a lot of pep. let him have a go. But, you know, there just comes a point where you're just like, well, I cannot see anything coming out of this government now.
I think what angers me about Jeremy Corbyn is the trenchant, on both sides, the sort of lack of any kind of facility to sort of listen, it seems. It is that is their way or no way. And while I have sympathy for... What really annoyed me actually about the Brexit debate last night was when Barry Gardiner sort of lightly attacked Caroline Lucas... and trying to paint Remainers as people who are sort of dismissing the working class and we're saying they're stupid and they were dupes and that actually we don't understand that they were voting against austerity and they were voting against... Well, he then conflated two things. He was saying, well, you know, they're voting against because the EU have made them poorer. It's like, no, you mean the Tories. You mean, that's what you mean. It's not that the EU have made them poorer. And what annoyed me was that Remainers don't... know that, like we know, we're trying to stop Brexit because we don't want those people to suffer. It's not like we're going, you idiots, you were duped. I'm very much on the side of those people, and I would love a Labour government. I want. I'm left leaning, as are most actors and most people on this panel. But I would love for there to be a decent opposition, and it gives me no pleasure whatsoever to feel the way I'm feeling about Labour and Jeremy Corbyn. And I voted, and I've said this before, but I voted. I felt I had to vote Lib Dem in the last election, which was now I feels like a massive waste of time, because I was so angry that nobody in Labour was offering, one of the Labour weren't offering any way out of Brexit. So I am just, I'm just really angry and disappointed in Jeremy Corbyn, frankly. Sad face. Sad face.
Can I just add briefly to that? There's so much talent in the Labour Party. There's a lot of talent there. There are really good people. You know, Hilary Benn, I think, is great. Keir Starmer has his great strengths.
Yvette Cooper.
We love Yvette Cooper. And the younger generation, Stella Creasy and so on. And all this is just kind of crushed under Corbyn and is not being heard because of that. And that is immensely frustrating for me because, frankly, with any of those people in charge, Labour, I think, would be 20 points ahead in the polls now.
I think of this every time I see Richard Bergen. And I just think, how is it possible that name your Labour backbencher that you like is not on the front bench and Richard Bergen is? It's just every time I see him, I'm just like, man, anyone could be an MP. Anyone could be a shadow minister. Literally anyone. Anyway, Bergen. Our third scenario is that MPs take back control, good slogan, and Parliament moves for a people's vote. Anyone here like a people's vote? could that happen? Are there enough people's vote backers on the backbench yet to force it? Because there are more coming all the time. And do you think that as we go further down the road to hell, that more people will kind of peel off and go for it? Are we there yet? Do you think we would be there?
I think we can get there. And I think if you look at... So remember where we were in September when we had the Labour Party conference and, you know, John McDonnell, I mean, after they had this sort of ramshackle moment, all the local parties had tried to force them into adopting a sort of people's vote position. They had that late night meeting. They came out with their sort of sequenced set of, like, you know, we were trying to negotiate if we couldn't do that. We'd run a general election if we couldn't do that. Then we'd have a second referendum. And then John McDonnell came out the next day and was like, but wouldn't have Remain on the ballot. And you're like, wow, you absolute spectacular twat. Like, but then Keir Starmer goes up and does a speech and goes, Remain's on the ballot. And there was a response in the hall. And actually, politics often turns on those moments. And if you look from the point that that happened... Actually, McDonnell's been very firm the last few weeks. I think Jeremy Corbyn's been much firmer than he's been up until now on sort of on just how what that sequencing would look like and what would be entailed. Now, a general election is not a solution to anything because it's just, you know, basically like one side which is just profoundly evasive on anything that it says on this subject and the other side that just doesn't have a policy on it at all. So there's no way that you can find out what you want to do with Brexit by asking Jeremy Corbyn to go up against Theresa May. It doesn't accomplish anything. However, you understand why people are thinking that way, because ultimately what you have is deadlock in Parliament. And the solution has to be, how do you undo the deadlock? And you either do that by changing the ratio of MPs, or you do it by taking it out to the public at large. And so in that sequence, it sort of works, and you can sort of imagine a scenario in which Labour would say, OK, fine, we're backing it now. It's not impossible to imagine in a way that it really was very hard to imagine a few months ago. And then, so then the question is, you know, how many, because they've got all the other opposition parties there apart from the DUP. And then how many Tory MPs are there that would back it? And I think when you look at the sort of strength of the rebellions, it's slightly different. It's not exactly one for one, but you look at the strength of the rebellions last week in the Commons. And I think you got the numbers for that. I think when you start looking at people like Joe Johnson, really fundamentally changed something by coming out, because he kept his powder dry, you know, all of that. I think, you know, that changes things. It is doable. The numbers are potentially there, but Labour needs to get on board, and it has to happen in time. And by the time that we're talking about stuff happening in late January, where's the fucking time? Like, it's now. It has to happen now. Time is of the essence. I don't know if anyone's noticed that that's a key factor in this debate, and it really is quite important. And at the moment, they are finding ways of pushing it away and pushing it away, and the longer it gets pushed, the further into the future, the less viable any kind of second referendum becomes.
Yeah. Roz, here's a tough one for you. And I suppose I'm talking democratically as opposed to kind of what Remainers would like, should no deal be on the ballot? Should it be May's deal, Remain, no deal. Would it be legitimate to do it without no deal, kamikaze, Brian Harvey running himself with his own car option?
There are risks with no deal, but I think you have to have it on the ballot. I am aware that's controversial. The reason why I think it benefits Remainers is that it splits the Leave vote, and there will be people who cannot bring themselves to vote for even May's deal, and it will effectively split those people off, and hopefully that will benefit Remain. Less cynically, I think you have to get people to understand what no deal means, and we can because at the moment it's a fact that a lot of people think no deal means status quo. They think it's deal or no deal in the Noel Edman sense, which I keep going on about, really. But they do. They think no deal means status quo. And, of course, we know it doesn't. But we know it doesn't. But they don't know it doesn't. And only in the course of, I think, an People's Vote campaign would that finally get across to people and it would finally become apparent what it meant. So those are the reasons why I think... Given the way that I think even 6 months ago I wouldn't have said that, or 12 months ago, the way we've been relentlessly pushed towards a hard Brexit and the hardest of Brexits means I think that no deal has to be on the ballot paper. So three options.
Can we add to it though that you need to have? I'm waiting now. You have to applause. So I think that you need to separate out no deal, no deal, like no withdrawal agreement from. No trade deal, because if we say no withdrawal agreement, then we, you know, EU citizens' rights would be included in that, and we can't have that, you know. Oh, and similarly, less importantly, we can't have anything on like it would be weird to say to a government you can't sign an aviation treaty with the EU. That's just, I don't think that's what people mean. I mean, it has to be we're not going to do a trade deal before the date of, you know, April 1st or whatever, and then that bit would go ahead. And there it's there. I agree. It's hard. I've held both positions. With alarming frequency on the no deal ballot thing.
Yours is really the more hard. Responsible.
And Ingrid, there's a lot of talk, obviously, about, you may have heard the phrase, the will of the people. And is it 900 days that it's been since the referendum now? Or approximately 900 days? And as a guest on the show this week, delicately referred to what we might call demographic churn or cohort shift? Or... whatever, you know, people
dying,
moving on to another place. That actually, of course, there is a kind of the whole question of the mandate. On the one hand, you've got this kind of the demographics keep eating away at that mandate, and on the other hand, and I know that this is something that Brexiters and on the left and right often say is you just go, it's very patronising to say that people didn't know what they voted for, but it seems to me it's an actual fact. Because if anyone said, has anyone just got, I voted for this, literally what's going on right now is absolutely is screaming nightmare. I turned to my wife in the polling booth and I just went, I think that I'm voting for a contempt motion. I'm voting for just paralysis, you know, all of that. Bring it on. But nobody knew. I didn't know when I was voting. I didn't know what I was voting against in that sort of detail. Do you know what I mean? I knew that I didn't want to leave the EU. But nobody, it's a nonsense to say that people knew what they were voting for when already there's. It's just endless sort of permutations and unforeseen events. So sorry.
No, of course it's. I thought there was a question.
There was.
Right?
There was.
I was just waiting
for it. And I lost
it.
So my point being, at what point... It's here somewhere.
No, don't worry. I'll jump in with something.
No, some point... Like, the whole idea of a mandate and the will of the people.
Yes.
When you're getting close to, you know, when you're 2.5 years past that, for all of these... And you know, where there was a binary choice... How much does that mean? Do you believe that there is a mandate, and do you believe that at some point it has to expire?
Yes.
Really? After all that struggle to ask that question, you switch. Yes.
Thank you. It is interesting because when people say, "Oh, people have died," people have died and moved on, so actually now it looks different. I'm slightly wary of that argument because that's just the nature of. That's just the nature of life. People die and people stay. And so, I'm slightly wary of that argument. But what I like is what Caroline Lucas, I think, described it as the mandate. As in this, if we had another referendum, it would be the first vote on what the actual deal will look like. So that, to me, makes the most sense. That's not saying you're all dupes, people have died, we're all different human beings now, our cells have been replaced, and we're about 7 years, not 2.5 years.
Like Trigger's broom.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, this is the first look on the deal. Yeah. So that is, for me, what the referendum should be about. And the whole thing of the will of the people, it's so interesting. Brexiteers, I feel like they've all been herded into a room and had, like, Paul McKenna go, right, what you need to keep saying is will of the people, and then, because there's not much else behind it. I do understand their argument that, you know, we haven't actually implemented Brexit, so we can't therefore say it hasn't worked. But they know that it's a very, they're standing on shifting sands and a very, what's it called, house of cards. It's all going to come tumbling down.
Well, there is the thing, if they were so certain, then they would just go, yeah, another referendum.
Exactly.
Endless referendums. Yeah. We'll win them all. But they're not saying that.
I know that argument, what I hate, and I hear people, friends say it, we're like, well, what's it, best of three? It's like, no, not fucking best of three. Best of one. Best of, if we now know what we're voting, if we now know what we're voting for, then that's it. And then if we still vote to leave, fine. Like, I mean that. I'm not just trying to trick people into remaining. As much as I want that to happen, I genuinely mean, if we have another vote, I will respect the results of that referendum once we know exactly what we're dealing with.
Quite.
Round of applause. No,
and we'll win.
Whatever. It's all right. Forget it. Don't worry.
Victory. Finally, it is... Oh, it's my turn for a present. And Roz is going to ask me the searching question.
It's for you.
It's a first aid kit.
First aid kit. Very useful.
What's inside it?
It's first plasters, alcohol. Alcohol pad.
Only a pad of alcohol. Okay.
It's always disappointing when you've asked for alcohol and you get alcohol pads. So I have to ask, how can we heal the
wounds? Yeah, exactly. How can we ever come together? How can we
move forward?
You know, because we're all friends in this room, but how can we come together as a country?
Well, as Ian said earlier, there is like a gaping wound. Did you probably didn't use the word gaping?
I wish I had.
Yeah. A sort of gaping wound in Britain, and I think there was a good John Harris piece in The Guardian today saying that a lot of this stuff was there before, but David Cameron had the clever idea of going, why don't we bring all the poison to the surface? So then we can see it. And I feel like there's a huge job to be done in terms of, I mean, I think it's far too early to talk about bringing the country together. You know, when that's another thing I've heard from Labour, a deal that will bring the country together. It doesn't exist. The country doesn't really want to come together. And I think there are some things that... And I don't even know the country was together in the first place. Like, a lot of the people who voted Leave were people that... they were the reasons I moved away from where I grew up. It's sort of... That's not a class thing at all. It's like a kind of... As a lot of this is largely sort of, you know, regional and cultural values-based. And I feel like there are certain issues which are impossible to reconcile in terms of, if you're talking about immigration, and I know that some people say, well, if, you know, Remainers should be much tougher on immigration to win over Leavers, and then it's like, I think, well, what's the point of being a Remainer? It just seems to sort of ruin the point if you're betraying one of your primary values. But I think the easy choice to make is the damage done by austerity, the neglect of regions, a sense of kind of, you know, hopelessness and lashing out. And these are things that any government should want to fix, not just because it has unfortunate, you know, consequences on one particular issue, but of course it's terrible for the country. It's terrible for their individual lives. It's terrible for the way the country feels about itself. It has all kinds of unforeseen consequences. And when you look back, and I suppose the fact that I feel the Conservatives seem to have given that no thought, and you could say that previous Labour governments did not give some of these issues enough thought, But we would, you would have to, if we had a people's vote and Remain won, you know, I'd kind of want a Labour government then, because I don't see a Tory government being able to kind of reach out and go, sorry about austerity, guys. That was terrible. You know, let's give you a helping hand. I think you would need a kind of major rethink to stop those, you know, to stop these areas feeling as neglected. Because when I've gone on holiday to various places around England or on work trips, since the referendum, there's things I look at and I go, this is quite Brexit. And I'm not saying that in a kind of sometimes saying it a sneery way, if it's certain kinds of pub, very kind of gammony pubs, and I go, this is very Brexit. But then there's other places where you go and there's kind of like, there's one row of really nice shops and the chain shops and a good Wetherspoons, and then you go a couple of streets back from the seafront or whatever, and you see all these kind of closed shops, and there's a real sense that that nobody really cares. And I think that's was such a huge driver, and I think that's of the referendum result. And that's one thing where I do agree with the messages coming from Corbyn, where, you know, obviously I wish he didn't just concentrate on this aspect, but when he does say, well, like, think about why this happened, and a lot of it happened with people sort of lashing out, and just to try and think about how you could, I know it sounds crazy, but try and think about how you could improve people's lives and stop them feeling hopeless, would be a good step forward, and to try and use it as a kind of opportunity for sort of national renewal. And I don't think, to be honest, that most Remainers just want to go back to early, you know, June the 1st, 2016, and go, that was fine, because it clearly wasn't. There we go. And so, we reached the end of the last Remaniacs Live of 2018. Thanks to Roz, Ingrid and Ian for joining me tonight. Thanks also to Naomi Smith, Alex Andreu, Nina Schick, all our producers, and our shadowy paymaster, Andrew Harrison, for making the show so enjoyable to do all year. We want to thank everyone who listens to the podcast, everyone who came to the show, especially our Patreon backers, whose generosity enables us to keep going and cover costs. And I think, does anyone want to offer a word of hope for next year?
That's not really part of my personal branding.
No, that's not you. Not you. I'm just an exception. No, I do think perhaps if there is a people's vote, I think that would be emotionally such a valuable thing, because there would be somewhere for us to put all of this energy. Without one, I don't know where it will go.
No, look, I agree, but I also think that... Okay, so that regardless of what happens at this stage, whether it's sort of best-case scenario of people's vote, whether it's the sort of comatose scenario of a May deal or like protracted negotiations that keep us in basically sort of a suboptimal position, or whether it's the disaster of no deal, the thing that is positive that comes out of it is that actually, for the last 2.5 years, people have had a sense of identity around believing in an open society and believing in liberal values, liberal with a small L, but of thinking, no, I want people to be free. I want people to be free to come here. I want people to think that they can be a citizen of a country and also a citizen of a world. And I want them to think that they are capable of thinking about politics in a complex, autonomous, individual way, a way that isn't just bullied by people going, well, you've got to sign up to the will of the people. You've got to sign up to my very simple solution. And that is, there is a sense of self-awareness to people who think like me, who I don't think we always had. I think we were just on the sort of winning side, and everyone, you know, whether it was Cameron or Osborne or whether it was Tony, but they all said, oh, we're pro, you know, open, you know, societies, and we think it's good there's diversity. And that sort of killed any sense of identity that we had. Now we're in opposition. We are basically the barbarians at the gate. And that gives you a sense of identity and a sense of group and a sense of movement and a sense that you need to be fighting for these things, because when you don't fight for them, people who are more marginalised than you, who are worse off than you, are the ones that suffer, who become the victims of it. And that goes regardless of the scenario. People's vote, no deal, anything in between, you have to fight for your values. And that's what we're going to do in 2019.
Well, thank you. We do have, because there's nobody on after us, because they just said we can't follow that. So we do have a little time for questions. Is there somebody
in the audience with a microphone? I don't mean has someone brought one with them. I mean, is our producer Andrew there? There we go.
Shadowy paymaster. Do we have any questions?
I love the way Andrew's walking around with a beer and a mic. Classic.
If it's not fun, it's not my revolution, man. Well, here you go.
Hi. Can I try and inject some positive spin / conspiracy theory? It was really noticeable that when Yvette Cooper asked Theresa May at the Select Committee hearing whether she was the kind of person that would take us into a no deal, Theresa May ducked the question. And then over the weekend, there was, you know, lots of briefing out both ways of whether the vote was going to be delayed. And it was only after the ECJ judgment came out this morning that actually finally this afternoon, Theresa May came out and said no. So just one, do you think Theresa May is actually prepared to take us into a no deal? And is she really playing sort of legislative chicken for real? She'll actually do it. And two, do you think she waited until she knew she had that kind of parachute cord that she could pull in all, you know, if all else fails, if the hardcore Brexiteers would really take us to that cliff edge before she actually made the decision to defer the vote?
I don't know. It's so hard to figure out what the fuck it is that she thinks, because she is so evasive and so secretive. I mean, you're quite right in your assessment of what, you know, the exchange between her and Yvette Cooper, but then she refused to answer any question during that exchange. So you sort of think, well, you know, this one or that one, it doesn't make any difference because she never answers anything. What I and my instinct is to say, no, Theresa May is still enough of a sort of grown-up that she wouldn't inflict no deal and she wouldn't force it through against parliamentary opposition. However, she wasn't going to give Parliament any say even on triggering Article 50. She tried to make sure that it had no say on her deal. She tried at length and only gave up last week when being humiliatingly defeated to stop it having amendments on her statement that it was no deal. Now, it could be that that is just in order to placate the ERG and blah, 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 or it could be that she's a fucking maniac.
Andrew...
Hold tight.
What I have been trying to grapple with is how really to convince people who haven't seen the light and who have the religion of Brexit to see rationally and change to the other side. So the fear I have, for example, of putting no deal on the ballot, if there should be one, is that it doesn't matter if it's on or off. If people have the religion, they don't seem to want to listen and they don't want to change their mind. What advice could you give to somebody who tweets every morning for an hour to try to convince people that there might be hope at the end of the line?
My immediate instinct would be to say, don't waste your time. Not with people who, sadly, with people who very much think differently in that way. You can't. And that's, I think we forget, I mean, it is easy on both sides. Sometimes you look at people, you go, I do not understand how you can have that position. I do not understand how you can think you would rather crash out with a no deal and make yourself poorer and have chaos ensue than remain. But people do. And so that's just a different personality type. You're never going to get through to them. But the people that we're trying to target, I think, are the people who are softer leavers. And with those people, there was a very interesting article actually in the, I think it was the New Statesman, about the things we must now as Remainers do to try and persuade people or to try and bring people on board and bring them over to our side. And things that do not help are things like saying you were tricked. As much as you want to use that as an argument, you have to sort of... It's like a relationship. As a woman, I find if I want my boyfriend to do something, I drop a few hints, I listen to his point of view, then sort of leave it there and hope that sense will prevail and he'll think it was his idea and he will change his mind. What doesn't help...
Dude, he's in the audience.
I know, he's in the audience. By the way, I've never done that with you, baby. I'm in so much trouble tonight when I get home. No, but I, you know, it's that thing of gentle persuasion with a velvet glove rather than Lion Fist. But there are articles. We should all Google. We should all, actually, in this room, everyone in this room, I think it is our duty and incumbent on us to work out from this point on, we have to sort of leave the anger a little bit. I mean, the anger is good because it fuels you. But we have to work out what we do now. Was it the New Statesman? Does anyone
just
ring a bell?
It's like a 7-point.
Yeah, thing. 7 points. Seven points. Look it up. Everyone should look it up in this room, and take these things on board. And I'm trying to tweet slightly differently because of that as well.
But there's quite a tough thing because I think that there's sort of two kinds of behaviour that are very valuable, but they're almost sort of they're valuable in such different contexts. So the advice that I think Best for Britain when they're training people as well, say if you're going out to talk to Leave voters, you know, no EU flags, no. Podcast called Romaniacs. Similarly, like the FBPE hashtag, which has brought a lot of people together, is incredibly alienating to people who are, not in that group. And so it's really hard because a lot of the things that you do where you feel most passionate and they're a great source of solidarity and strength, when it comes to the people's vote, which is fine now, really, but when it comes to the campaign, it's sort of... I don't know. I'm probably not going to change the name of the podcast. But I think you almost have to shift into another mode when you're talking to these soft leavers because, so that their hackles don't go up. And I think that's going to be quite hard. And I've noticed some people on Twitter talking about whether to drop the FPPE hashtag because they think that it is, if there's a people's vote, it could be counterproductive. And I think that we would have to have those conversations.
Any more questions? I'm on the wrong side of the room. Hang on.
Loads.
Just determining this in terms of geography rather than if it's a good question. Hang on. Here you go. You're the lucky winner.
Given what May did today, I found so terrifying, do you think people like Dominic Grieve should actually be handing in letters to the 1922 committee? Seriously, I'm not being flippant.
No, because there's no time. I'm really wary of replacing her just because I don't see where the time is. If the problem is fundamentally a time problem and the solution involves a 12-week Tory leadership contest, which goes out to the membership and wouldn't necessarily involve someone more Brexity coming back, then I would like to explore other avenues. And not in a happy way, because I feel like she's boxed herself in on the second referendum as well, so I'm... Obviously, it goes without saying, she is suboptimal as a prime minister in any possible spectrum of what that might entail. But I just don't see that right now replacing her gets us to a better place. I don't see that.
I think we've got time for two more. I've run to the wrong side of the room. The questions are all over there. Oh, you can have one. You're here.
Hi. So, practically, people like us in the room here, what can we actually do, grassroots campaign, going forward, changing people's minds or pushing towards a people's vote, especially people like me? I don't have a UK passport, so I can't vote. Taxation without representation. I can, of course, give vast amounts of cash to Romaniacs, which I do. Well, not vast amounts
That's
of
not
cash.
A tax, but by the way, just so we're clear.
But what kind of practical things can normal people on the street do to get out of this mess?
Yes. I think get out there and campaign. Get out there and make your voice heard. There are people now I see increasingly at weekends hanging around Archway Tube, trying to change my mind about Brexit, but in a good way. Archway Tube may not be the best place to hang about, really. Given that, I think it's important to have conversations and keep talking to leavers. And this is picking up on your point as well. You have to give some people something else, because right now there's nothing for these people but Brexit, and nobody is offering them anything else. And there is no kind of there's no promise of more help. The problems they face, we have to look forward. We have to make a positive case for what can be achieved without Brexit, and we have to be to say we can move on. We don't have to do this thing. This isn't a matter of pride And you know, if we decide to stop Article 50 now, that's fine. It's not a big deal. It's okay. It's not a matter of national pride. It just means we can concentrate on the stuff that is really urgent in this country, and it's really important, and we really need to fix. And God knows there are so many of those things that we really need to fix in this country. And to move the conversation on to something other than actually Brexit, I think is the key thing to do. And to say, yeah, now, we want this out of the way so we can focus on the important stuff.
I think there are some really good, there's groups obviously like Best for Britain, but the European Movement, when I did a sort of an article at the beginning of the year and I was talking to a lot of the activists, and they were very well informed about what works or what they thought worked and what doesn't. And they're very, you know, there's a lot of grassroots energy, which is why I really hate it when people present the Remain People's Vote movement as sort of top down, and they think it's all just sort of Alastair Campbell and Peter Mandelson doing a kind of New Labour reunion tour. And actually, a lot of it has come from the grassroots. That's how this kind of movement ended up forming. And a lot of them have actually been thinking about this since the last referendum campaign. So definitely kind of look up those groups, you know, Britain in Europe, Best for Britain, European Movement. There's many. There are many. And a lot of them have already thought very hard about some of this sort of subtle persuasion stuff that might not necessarily be obvious.
I think Best for Britain have a, if I remember correctly, so contact Naomi Smith on Twitter if you don't see it, otherwise well, you just sign up there. But I think that they have a sort of, they've got seats of MPs who are particularly susceptible to the message, where you put in the work there to try to convince the constituents who'll be sending off stuff to the MPs, and they have a system for that. None of it interests me, because I just basically want to sit at home in my Batman underpants and blog. That's the entirety of what gives me joy in this world. But nevertheless, for other people, they actually want to accomplish stuff with their lives, and that may be the way to do it. So I don't know.
Do we have time for one more?
We've got time for one more. Make it a good one. How much is Soros paying you? Hang on, right. This man is wearing a Christmas jumper that says, all I want for Christmas is EU, so he is stealing our intellectual property. Here you go.
So it's actually a really negative question to finish on, but Ingrid kind of touched on this earlier. Like, I've been talking about kind of all the energy and we put that into a people's vote, potentially. But what would you think if we actually lost, or you know, Remain lost the people's vote, actually ultimately Leave won again? Where does the energy go then? Like, that's kind of the end game, right? Like, what happens then?
Well, then Remain has put all their energy into getting a good Brexit deal, because that's what we should have been doing all along, because then we would have had a good Brexit deal. If any, we'd put our energies towards getting a good Brexit deal. No, I mean, I think, if there is another referendum, and again, as you said, we are talking, I mean, we're up against it, because even if it was happening in the next few months, that's not a huge amount of time to get the message out that we want to get out, so people can have an informed vote. But if the results was the same, and it could be, then we'd have to do it. I feel like we'd have to do it. We couldn't go, actually, sorry, when I said that this was definitely the
best
final
of five,
because then we would be those guys, and that would be really bad. So we'd have to suck it up and do it. But I don't think that'll happen.
I would say that a lot of people after June 2016 did not know what they were going to do next, and it took quite a long time. And now the People's Vote campaign, which they arrived at through thinking through many options, and there were disagreements over strategy and messaging and all that, and they arrived at this kind of united front, and people were going, well, this is never going to happen. And they fought, and they brought out, you know, hundreds of thousands of people onto the streets. And they're moving MPs every week. There's other people coming round, and celebrities and business people. They've achieved far more than people thought they were going to achieve when the People's Vote campaign launched. Was that spring, early summer? And far, far more than anybody was expecting in that horrible kind of morning after the referendum. So I think it's very hard to say in advance what people would do. But I think when you see the amount of kind of talent and sort of energy and sort of, I don't know, I found honesty and sort of moral vigour and passion that has come up around this movement, I don't know where people would decide that they wanted to take that next, but I do think that it wouldn't just fade away. There is no way that sector of the population would just go, forget it, lads.
and ladies. No,
it just wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't happen. So I know that sounds a bit vague, but I've seen what happened when people kind of picked themselves up from what felt like this horrible defeat and have already achieved a great deal, even if we're not there yet. And I think something positive for the country could come out of this broad movement and of people who feel this way.
A Remainiacs Netflix series.
That, yes. Cool. Well, we have to go, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for coming out, and happy Brexmas, everyone.
Please give it up.